This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
You go through the stage of needing something and wanting something, and then you get what you want, and then you have enough. There's such a thing as having too much of material things. In Ruchnius, it goes the opposite way. You can never have enough. The more you learn, the more you want to learn. The more mitzvahs you do, the more mitzvahs you want to do. One would think after there not being a shir for 4 weeks, one would think that the place would be crowded up. So it's a raya for the chazal that it's right. When you're out of practice of Torah, it's very hard to get back in. But not only is it hard to get back into the routine of learning, it's actually hard to get back into the cheshek for learning, to the desire for learning. That's the biggest problem. That's why I always say to you, there's no such thing as taking a break from learning. If you're away or you're on holiday or whatever it is, every day something. Make quite sure that you force yourself, whatever you do. Because as hard as it is to learn today, if you don't learn today, it's going to be twice as hard tomorrow. And if you don't learn today and tomorrow, it's going to be three times as hard the next day. That applies not only to learning, but it applies to any mitzvah, to any seder of things, any regular activity that one has, which is important. All the Yetzer Hara has to do is to stop you doing it once, and then the thin edge of the wedge is in, and from there you can move on. That's why people who are not regular to shir are wasting their time. There's no way that one can learn, because the amount of time it takes to get back into swing after missing one shir, by that time the guy's already missed another shir, and he's just perpetually catching up. There's just no point in learning if one isn't going to be learning seriously. And unless one goes to one of the big shuls, there it's designed for light entertainment, so that whenever you come, you get something. That's what the big shuls are for, and they serve a very important function in that way. That you come, you hear a bit of chazonos, you hear a drosha, you hear something, you go away with something, that's fine. But that's not how a ben Torah learns Torah. When a ben Torah is learning Torah, it's kaseder every single day. It's got to be regular, with commitment, and he mustn't miss. It's terribly, terribly hard. As the thoughts for the shir this evening developed, they started developing into two sections, and I was still going to combine the two sections and give two, you know, part one and a part two of the shir this evening. But as it developed, part two became a major section all on its own, and I didn't want to detract from it by part one. So I'm in fact going to give the shir in two sections over this week and next week. So this week we'll have the lighter and easier part, and next week we'll have some very interesting stuff arising out of it. The parsha that I'm going to be concentrating on is the parsha of the Nikmas HaMidyonim, the taking revenge from the Midianites. Now, the concept of taking revenge we've already discussed. The fact that although there's an issur of lo siko and lo sito, although one isn't permitted to take revenge under normal circumstances, we've discussed on the other hand, kol talmid chacham she'en anokem v'noter ein a talmid chacham, that if a talmid chacham doesn't know how to take revenge, he's not considered a talmid chacham altogether. We've discussed the fact that Torah, by its very nature, sometimes does require the taking of revenge when it's in the interests of Torah and not in the interests of any personalities. And so we have a situation here where the Ribbono Shel Olam instructs Moshe, Nakoim Nikmas Bnei Yisrael Me'es HaMidyonim, take revenge on behalf of the Bnei Yisrael from the Midianites, Achar Te'osef Elamecha, after that you're going to die. Moshe then organizes the people. He himself doesn't go with. That's what we're going to discuss next week. Why Moshe, although he was instructed by the Ribbono Shel Olam to do it himself, he doesn't go with. He sends Pinchas, and he sends an army, and off they go into Midian. Vayitzbu'u al Midian, and they declared war on Midian, kasher tzivu Hashem es Moshe, as God had commanded Moshe, vayahargu kol zochar, and they killed every male, every man of Midian. Ve'es malchei Midian hargu al chalaleihim, and they killed the kings of Midian over their bodies, Es Evi Ves Rekin, and it names the five kings of Midian. The Es Bilam ben Beor Horgu Bechorov, and our old friend Bilam ben Beor was also killed at that same time. What was Bilam doing there? As a machlek is what he was doing there, but whatever it was mischief. The one view is that he went to collect his fees, which were considerable. He felt that he'd done a decent job of work. And the other view is that he went to give some more advice, that he was called in for consultations. But being there at the time, he was killed, and that was a very important part of the exercise, was to in fact get Bilam. Vayishbu b'nei Yisrael es nashei Midyan v'estapon, and the b'nei Yisrael then took the wives of Midyan and their little ones in captivity. Vayeskol behemton v'eskol mikneim v'eskol chelon bazozu, and all their cattle and all their animals and all their wealth they took as spoil. Vayeskol areihim b'mashroisom v'eskol tiroisom sofa v'esh, they burnt down their castles and their cities. And they took all the spoil among men and cattle, and they brought it all to Moshe. No, there was no plundering, nobody took anything for themselves. It was all brought to Moshe, it was all brought to the camp, to the Arvos Moav, where the Bnei Yisrael were camped, which was opposite Yerecho, next to the Yarden. Vayetsu Moshe ve'elozor ha'koyin v'chol nisiyo ha'ido likroso mel mechutz la'machane. And Moshe and Elozor ha'koyin and all the princes of the community went out to meet the returning army outside the camp. They went to show them the cover, the meeting of the returning army, an army who had fought on their behalf. Vayiktsoif Moshe al pekudei ha'koyin. And Moshe got angry with the officers. Soreha Alokim and Soreha Meyos, the officers of the thousands and the officers of the hundreds, Haboyim Mitzvah HaMilchomo, who came back from waging the war. Vayomer Aleim Moshe, and Moshe said to them, Hachayisim Kol Nekevo? What do I see here? Did you leave the women alive? Hein Heino, you live in Israel, Bidvar Bilam, they were the ones who called all the trouble by the advice of Bilam, who caused all the trouble by the advice of Bilam, Limso Mal Bahashem Al Devar Peor, to make these people disobey the Ribbono Shel Olam on the matter of Pe'ol, that he hamagefo be'adas Hashem, and there was a plague among the community of Israel in which thousands of people died. Ve'ato, and now, let's picture the situation. The war is over. The men have all been killed. Who have you got coming back? A vanquished group of women and children. Ve'ato, and now, hirgu kol zachor batot, kill every baby boy. The whole isha yodas ish lemishkov zochar haroiger, and any woman past the age of puberty, you shall kill. The whole hataf banoshim asher lo yodu mishkav zochar, and all the children, the female children who have not yet reached the age of puberty, hachayu lochem, they can be left alive. Imagine such a thing. So the army now has to take out their swords and murder these innocent women and children. That's what they have to do. It's a very, very difficult function. What damage can still be caused by these women? They don't have any men, they're no Midianite men, so they're either going to die out in any case, or they're going to intermarry into the Jewish people ultimately, or they're going to intermarry with other nations. Something's going to happen. What's the big threat? Why is it necessary? Okay, the army made a mistake, maybe they should have been killed. We have to examine why they should have been killed. But now to go and take this camp of innocent people and wipe them out. Very strange. And even if one will say that the women were not so innocent, that there's some very young ones among them too. And the little boys, the little baby boys, can you imagine the difficulty? Can you imagine how harsh one would have to be to take out one's sword and start killing the little baby boys? 5 years old, 4 years old, 3 years old, 2 years old, 1 day old, 6 months old, you have to kill them all. You imagine the bloodshed that was there. It's not a pleasant thought. And you think I'm cruel to children. That's the first thing we've got to try and understand. What's the story of what they did to... What's Bilam's involvement in all this? Says Rashi, Amar lahem, Bilam said to them, Afilu atem machnisim kol hamoynes sheba'olam, even if you will take all the people in the world, Ein atem yecholim lohim. Bilam now talking to the people of Midian. Even if you collect all the armies of the whole world, you will not be able to beat Am Yisrael. Shema merubim atem min haMitzrim sheyushesh meos rechev bochu. Do you think you're any stronger than the Egyptians who had 600 tanks that went out with chosen armies against them at the time when Am Yisrael certainly had nothing at all and they weren't able to succeed? In other words, what Bilam is telling them is, don't try and use conventional warfare because you'll lose. These people have a secret weapon, and unless you can shoot out their secret weapon, you don't have a chance of being able to win the war. So don't think that with your army you're going to win. Come, says Bilam, I'll give you an advice how to do it. The God of these Jews hates immorality. And Rashi leaves it there. The Isa Bechelik of the Sifri. Of course, as Rashi, you know the famous Gemara. Someone has to search around for the famous Gemara, and we find the famous Gemara. It's in Sanhedrin Daf Kuf Vav 106a. And the Gemara says the following. I think we've done this Gemara before. Omar lahem, he said to them, Elokeim shel elu soinei zima. The God of these people hates immorality. Vehem misavim liklei pishtan. And they like fine linen items. They're attracted, they like it, they appreciate good linen. Boi va'atziyocha etza. Come, I'll tell you a good advice, he says to the Midianites. Osei lohem keloim, make shops for them, v'hoshiv bohen zoynus. And instead of staffing the shops with shopkeepers, staff the shops with prostitutes. Zekeino mibachutz, put an elderly prostitute outside. Because obviously if there's a young and attractive prostitute sitting in front of the shop, the Bnei Israel wouldn't go anywhere near the shop. They're not allowed to, they wouldn't come near. But if you put some ugly old women outside the shop selling very fine linen, the Bnei Israel will come and look at the linen. That's step number one. The Yoldo mibifnim, and put an attractive young girl at the back of the shop. The Yimkur alehen klei pishta. And that way you can sell them beautiful linen items, and you'll have a relationship going already. Also, lahin kloyin mihar shalag ad beis hayeshimis. He did so. The king of Midian made these shops all the way from Har Shalag right to beis hayeshimis. V'hoshiv bohem zoynos, and he did as he was advised by Bilam. He put prostitutes there, zakeinu mibachutz v'yoldo mibifnim, an old lady on the outside and a young lady inside. And what happened? What's the whole chokhmah? When the Jews go outside of their homes, only after they've had a good meal, they've had a sudishal mitzvah, and they go out for a walk after the meal before they sit down to learn. Normally they're all in their bosei medrash, but when did the Jew come outside? He comes, he's had a party, they've had an occasion to have a meal and a bit of a drink, and they're happy. They take a walk up and down, and then they go back to learn. So, b'shor sheYisrael oichlim v'shoisim v'speichim, at the time when some Jews were eating and were drinking and were happy, the Yotzin Latayel Bashuk, and they went out to walk up and down in the marketplace. Omeris Loi Hazakena Iatamavakesh Klei Pishtan. An old woman approaches them and she says, "Excuse me, sir, wouldn't you like to look at some linen items I've got here?" Zakena Omeris Loi Bashovit. They say to her, "How much does it cost?" And she says, "100 rand for this one." The Yoldo Imis Loy Befachis. And inside, a girl shouts out, "I'll sell it to you for 90. And now the Jews start thinking they can get a bargain already. So they say to the old one, "Can you beat the price of 90? Shtayim v'sholosh po'omim." And this goes on a few times. She says, "Yes, I'll give it to you 85. And you hear a voice from inside, "I'll give it to you for 80. The old lady comes down to 75. The young one says 70. The old lady says, "Sorry, I can't compete with that." Now you've got to go and find out what the young lady's got to sell for 70. So the next thing she says to him is, "Make yourself at home. Sit down." I must tell you, if you ever have the misfortune to walk into a watch shop in Hong Kong, for example, it doesn't have to be a watch shop, it can be any shop, the first thing they tell you is they bring you a chair. You're just coming to find out the price of something. You're not interested in buying nothing. You just want to know how much it costs. It doesn't matter.
sit down, can we bring you some tea? That's how they start. Okay? Harayat kevin bais, please feel at home, shame, sit down. Beroy la'atzmecha, still choose which you like. And they start bringing out the wares, and this one, and that one, and he starts choosing. Betzatzuri shel yayin amoni munach etzla. And very conspicuously, there is standing an attractive jar of amoni wine, which was obviously very good wine. V'adayin lo ne'esar yayin shel nochri. And at that stage, yayin nesef didn't yet apply if it wasn't actually used for yayin nesef, if it wasn't actually used for idolatry, which this wine wasn't. But wine which was touched by a non-Jew was not yet osu. Amro lo yaratzoin chashitishtei koshel yayin. Wouldn't you like a glass of wine? Kivan she'shoso boar boy. Once he drank the wine and you're sitting quietly, by this time the old lady has walked off and the doors of the tent have miraculously closed themselves, and all of a sudden you find yourself sitting and having a glass of wine with a very attractive lady. One could be in worse situations, but there's nothing wrong with that yet. The doors aren't locked, there's no Shiloh of Yichud yet. So, okay. Omar la hashmi'ili. After a while, the discussion starts becoming intimate. Hoitzio yiroso mitoicheko. She takes out her little idol from her bosom. Omro loy avoid leze. She says, do an avoida, serve this little idol. Omar loy halo Yehudi. Chas v'sholom. I'm a Jew. How can I have idol worship? It's out of the question. Omar loy ma'ich patlecha. What does it bother you? All we're asking for you is a peer is a disgusting expression of the human being on his lowest animal level. Basically, the avoider of Baal Peor, believe it or not, this we'll explain and discuss, was actually to excrete in front of him. That was the avoider of Baal Peor. Now, that might sound completely weird to you, but you'll see at the end of it that it's not so weird at all. That was the avoider of Baal Peor. He doesn't realize that that's the way you serve this idol. He thinks that, okay, that's an expression of disgust. To show disgust to the idol in order to carry on the very pleasant conversation we're having is not much of a price to play. And then not only that, ultimately she says, and furthermore, I will not have anything further to do with you until you deny the Torah of Moshe. How is this Jew going to move? A moment ago he wasn't prepared to consider idolatry, and she gets him to the point where he actually denies the Torah of Moshe. And then the Gemara brings a posuk from Hosea, which I'll do with you in a few minutes' time. That's the Gemara which Rashi brings. He just brings the beginning of it, and that's it. What does the Gemara appear to be saying? And this is the way it's normally understood. That the Moabites, the Ribbono Shel Olam, what did Bilam advise the Moabites? That the Ribbono Shel Olam is Soine Zino. He doesn't like this kind of immorality. And they indulge in it with the Moabites, and ultimately that even led to Avodah Zarah. But it appears that what Bilam is really trying to say is, look, their secret weapon is God. Now if you can get God angry with them, you're okay. How do you get God angry with them? By getting them involved in this kind of sexual immorality. That's the way the Gemara is normally understood. That's the way the Rashi is normally understood. But that's not what they complain about. When they get angry, they don't mention the sexual immorality. It says Moshe, Hein Heina Hayu Livnei Yisrael Bidvar Bilam. It's those women which were involved with the Jewish people in the words of Bilam, Limso Mal Ba Hashem Al Davar Pa'or, to make them transgress the word of God in the matter of the Baal Pa'or. That's what we're upset about. So why is the stress placed on the sexual immorality? Why does the Gemara start and Rashi starts with Soine Zima? This is a God who hates the immorality. Why doesn't it say Soine Avodah Zarah? What's the essence of what the Moabites did? That they got them to serve idolatry, or that they got them to have relationships with them? What is the essence of it? From the Pasuk it seems the essence is the idolatry. From Rashi in the Gemara it seems that the essence is the sexual immorality. That's the first question. The second question is even more surprising. Let's just look back and see what happened. After the whole business of Bilam cursing the people or blessing them as it turned out into the end. It says, Vayeshev Yisrael Bashitim. Israel was well settled in Shittim. Vayochel Ha'om Liznois El Benois Moyov. And the people started having relations with the prostitutes of the daughters of Moab. And they called them to their idolatrous parties, and they went and they bowed and they sang to their gods, etc., etc. God gets angry and there's a Magepha. People are wiped out. And finally, now who's that? That's the Moabites. Who are we talking about here? The Midianites. All it says about the Moabites is that business with Pinchas. V'hinei ish mibnei Yisrael bo, one Jewish man came, v'yakrev el Echov, and he approached his brothers Es HaMidyonis together with the Midianite woman Leinei Moshe. One Midianite woman is mentioned. The rest is Moabite. So what does the Torah make a whole fuss about? The Midianites and the Moabites you can leave. The Midianites have to be absolutely wiped out. The men, the women, the children, the lot, everyone except the little girls under the age of puberty, but the little boys have to be wiped out and all adults have to be wiped out. The Midianites, what about the Moabites? This question is asked by the Medrash and various answers are given, some of which Rashi brings over here. The answer which the Abarbanel gives, which for the purpose of this shir, is the answer we're going to take. And that is, says the Abarbanel, there was a major difference between the Moabites and the Midianite involvement. True, it started off with the Moabites. But that Midianite referred to at the end of Balak was not the only Midianite which crossed into the Jewish camp and caused all the problems. That was the ultimate already. It started with the Moabites, and then the Midianites were very closely related. You'll remember it was both the Moabites and the Midianites together who approached Bilam for his advice. So they're allies, they're two societies that live close together. After the Midianites saw the Moabites having these relationships with Am Yisrael, then the Midianites got involved. What's the difference, says the Abarbanel, in the case of the Moabites, it was plain hedonism. There was a Yetzirah, and they were attractive women, and the men became attracted, and it was a terrible tragedy. It was serious, and there was a Magepha, lots of the Jewish people died as a result of it. It was serious and everything, but that's not a reason to wipe out the Moabite people. That's the first thing. In fact, if you look at the words in Balak, you'll see that the grammar is rather interesting. It says, "Vayeshiv Yisrael bashitim vayochel ha'om liznois el benois Moab." The people made approaches of prostitution to the daughters of Moab. So it appears to be motivated from the Jewish side rather than from the Moabite side. For that we don't wipe out the Moabites. They didn't do anything wrong. They're attractive. They're entitled to be attractive. They showed off their attractiveness. They're also entitled to show off their attractiveness. But it was Am Yisrael who made the move. It was their fault. They died in the Magepha. That's not a reason to wipe out the Moabites. But the Midianites, those wicked Midianites, that's a different story. Because, says the Abarbanel, they simply used their seduction as a means of getting Am Yisrael to serve idolatry. They weren't interested in the prostitution. They were interested in the idolatry. They were interested in Baal Peor. That's what they wanted. They wanted to get Am Yisrael to serve Baal Peor. Again, that's not what appears to be from the Rashi, and it's not what appears to be from the Gemara. From the Gemara and from the Rashi, it appears that Elokeim shel elu seinei zimahu, the God of these people hates sexual immorality. And it seems to be that that's where they're trying to get. There's no mention of the Avodah Zorah until the end of it. And Rashi doesn't mention the Avodah Zorah altogether. On the other hand, the Pasuk, the Torah itself, only talks about the Avodah Zorah. Let's understand what the Midianite attack was. The Midianites stated, or Bilam told the Midianites, Elokeim shel elu soinei zimahu, the God of these people hates sexual immorality. So they're deprived. That's a pleasure they don't know about. That we can use. They would not indulge in sexual immorality because it's a prohibited thing in their religion. Strictly prohibited. It just wouldn't occur. That's their weak point. Not because we're going to make God angry. That would be too simplistic. To cause the Jews to do an Aveira and thereby make God angry, that wouldn't help either, because that's what the Moabites did. And it didn't really help. It didn't cause God to get angry enough with the Am Yisrael to the extent that they would lose the war against the Moabites. We want to go much further than that. We want God to wipe these people out completely. And that's not going to be achieved just by getting them to be naughty. The only way we're going to achieve God to leave them is if they leave God. We've got to get them to the point where they serve Avodah Zarah. That's what we've got to do. Which Avodah Zarah? Let's choose Baal Peor. Why Baal Peor? Because the God of these people hates sexual immorality, and that's the area in which the Yetzer Hara will be biggest. What does all this mean? To take a Jew who's been raised on Torah and Mitzvahs, as these Jews had been, who've been living a life of Kedusha Tahara, they've been sitting and learning, studying, serving the Ribbono Shel Olam for years and years, to take them and put them into a situation of sexual immorality. Some of them might fall for it, sure, only human, but not the bulk of them. That's not something with which the Midianites are going to really be able to tackle Am Yisrael, are really going to be able to destroy Am Yisrael. That's just not possible. Apart from anything, they're going to have tremendous feelings of guilt. How far are you going to get them? It's been knocked into their heads since early childhood that this is just not allowed. It's absolutely taboo. It cannot be. How far are you going to get them? Feelings of guilt will be so extensive that maybe, yes, they might come into the shop and they might buy some linen and they might have a glass of wine, but they're not going to go very far. They'll just feel too guilty. There's only one thing to do. You've got to teach them a religion of hedonism. You can't teach them that, look, your Torah says that this is taboo. Your Torah says sexual immorality is not allowed, but don't worry about your Torah. That wouldn't work against these people. You've got to teach them a new philosophy which is attractive to them. You've got to make an ideal out of the sexual immorality. You've got to make it attractive not only sexually, but you've got to make it attractive intellectually and spiritually as well. That's the way you'll get there. You've got to present them with something which appeals to their spirits. You've got to present them with something which appeals to their intellects. Something which they can't answer. That's what you've got to do. What is Baal Peor? Baal Peor is the 1960s. Baal Peor is no inhibitions. That's it. We're natural, normal people, free love, all this kind of thing. Baal Peor is to stand up in front of the God and do that which is most animal. Do that which is most physical. What better way can there be than to lose your inhibitions than that? There's a film showing at the moment called Kitty Returns to Auschwitz, I think. Is that what it's called? And it's a film that everybody should see. It's a very important film to see. And not only can you see it during the 9 days, you can see it on Tisha B'Av as well. And it's not a gory film at all. There's nothing gory. It doesn't get back. It's all filmed a couple of years ago. And there are no documentary shots from earlier. Nothing there that is filmed which is earlier than that period, in 1974 I think it was. But one sees certain things that happened there. And one of the interesting points is just that. A lot of emphasis is placed when this woman goes back to reliving the experiences which she coped with very well in the camp. And she explains how she survived, what she did to survive. It's important to know all these things. One of the things that she spends a lot of time on is the way that the Germans handled personal hygiene. To the extent where there were no toilets in Auschwitz until nearly the end of the war, no toilets. There were no changes of clothes. You had one set of clothes which you wore from the time you came in until the time you were liberated. Right? It was impossible to wash your clothes. Right? Things were crowded. The place was crowded. You were lucky if you had a bed to sleep on. You know what the beds were. You were lucky if you had a piece of wood to sleep on. The only utensil you had was a dish which you had to use for everything. That's all you had. And one thinks to oneself, well, what would have bothered them, the Germans? Okay, so you put up an evolution block. Would that be terribly serious?
Which they ultimately did, and you should see what kind of an evolution block. It wasn't much of an improvement. But one realizes that's how they demoralize the people. When you start losing your inhibitions about the most animal things that you have to do, where there's absolutely no privacy when it comes to doing the animal things. And that's what tsnius is really. Tsnius is that the very material and very physical things we hide. So we eat in a certain way to try and make our eating more human than animal. We don't make a noise when we eat. Because an animal makes a noise when he eats. We try and be different. Things are done with tsnius, they're done nicely. Anything which is physical, anything which is very material, we like privacy for. We don't eat in public. We don't eat in the street. We don't eat at buffets. We don't walk around with food in our hands. Right, those are just things we don't do. We have a feeling of tsnius when it comes to eating, and how much more so when it comes to things like personal hygiene and so on. To deprive the person, the human being, of his feeling of tsnius, of his feeling of privacy and intimacy with regard to his most animal of activities, deprives his feeling of humanity. He ceases to be human being at that point. To require, as the first introduction into the religion of Baal Peor, that a human being should excrete in front of his God, there's no inhibition after that. There's nothing to be embarrassed about after that. If you're able to do such a thing, if you're able to drop to such levels of depravity in the name of religion, that's the beauty of it, from their point of view. It's not depravity. This is truth. It's the hang-ups of modern man that doesn't allow you to do such a thing. That's the way you're brought up as a kid. Be natural. That's how the animals are. What's a human being any different? Be yourself. Drop your hang-ups. Let's see it in front of Baal Peor himself. He doesn't mind. The God doesn't mind. He made you like that. He wants to see you natural. That's Baal Peor. That's the 1960s. Those are the hippies. That's free love. That's the whole story. Making an ideal of depravity and calling it naturalism. Calling it as you really are. That's it. Turning a human being into an animal and saying that's an avoda. It is an avoda. An avoda zora. Absolute avoda zora. This is the essence of Baal Peor. That's what the avoda zora of Baal Peor is. And this Bilam realizes. Make a religion out of hedonism and you'll attract the Jews. Who were the founders of the hippie movement? Who were the big motivators, the big drivers? Who were the clever ones? Who were the ones who landed up making money out of it all? The goyim. That's something that appeals to Jews. Goyim don't need it. To present a Jew with an intellectual system of glorifying depravity, that's something that it's just up his street. Because he's deprived of depravity in his normal life. He has a certain moral and intellectual system of behaving. And in order to be able to justify depravity without feelings of guilt, you've got to turn it into an ideal. You've got to make it into a religion. In Victorian times already there was free love. In Victorian times already there was wife swapping. But nobody ever talked about it. Nobody ever knew about it. And a Jew would never have done it. That chas v'sholom. A Jew wouldn't have done it. When did the Jews start getting involved? As soon as it became glorified into a system. As soon as it became a principle. As soon as it became an ideal, a religion, a philosophy. That's the correct way to do things. Then the Jews fall. That's the end of it. In Bereshis, we're told, after the creation of man and woman, before the Chet, Vayihyu shnehem arumin, and the two of them were naked, ha'odom v'ishtoy, man and his wife, v'loy yisboy shoshu, and they were not embarrassed. Now is that told in praise of them, or in denigration of them? Surely in praise of them. That seems to go a little bit against what we're saying. So standing there, naked, and they don't even feel embarrassed. What is busha? And that's really the subject of the shir. We've discussed it once very briefly before on a Friday night. What is busha? Busha is the feeling of shame, as it's normally translated, but busha really means the feeling awareness of the gap between what I am and what I could be and should be. That's Busha. Busha is not feeling embarrassed about something I did in the past. Busha is a feeling of the present. I am not what I could be, and I'm embarrassed at the fact that I'm not what I could be. Adam, when he was created, and Chava, before the Chet, there was no difference between their potential and actual. They were their ultimate potential. That was man before the Chet. And that was what Adam chose to change by eating from the Eitz Hadas. He wanted to reach his potential himself. He didn't want to be created having reached that potential.
A little bit further, they eat from the tree. Batipachna ene shnehem. And their eyes were opened, they became wise. And what's the first thing they do with their wisdom? Vayedu ke'erum enehem. They're embarrassed. The first thing they realize is that they've dropped, and that they're no longer on the same level, and that there's a gap between potential and actual. Vayitpiru alei te'ena. And they immediately make themselves clothes. Why clothes? Two reasons. Firstly, the first thing they have to do is to cover their sexual organs. Because that's the area where it becomes most obvious that the difference between actual and potential exists at all times. The potential of greatness in the correct use of the sexual relationship is so incredibly great. And the depravity that there can be also by the incorrect use of the sexual relationship can be so base that the potential gap between them is so great that that's the first area of feeling busha, that's the first area of shame. But more than that, we discussed, this is the point that we discussed that Friday night, clothes are representative of the image one creates. Clothes is how you want to appear, not how you really are. Right? Carter, we've discussed many times, when he came into the White House, tried to change all that, and he wanted to say, look, honest government, accept me as I really am. I wear jeans and a jersey. That's where it is. And when it's cold, then the temperature in the White House, in the winter, I keep my heating low to save energy, like all you little people, and therefore I have to wear two jerseys. And if you think I look ugly wearing two jerseys, and I don't wear a suit because I'm cold in a suit, then you must know this is honest government. And he just dropped in the polls. Nobody wants that. That's not honesty. That's a lack of busha. That's a man who thinks he's everything. That a man is a man who has the chutzpah to think that take me as I am because I'm good enough. That's a lack of busha. What the American people wanted to see is an American who dresses up in their honor. Who says, look, normally when I'm on my own I may wear two jerseys and jeans, but when I appear on television I'm going to be wearing a suit out of respect to you. That's how it is, because that's considered the formal way of dressing. And that's how you expect me to dress. Clothing is a way of presenting yourself, of projecting yourself to your society in a way which makes you appear how you want to appear, not how you really are. If you really wanted to appear how you really are, you should go around naked. That's it. If you really want to be honest, go around naked. The moment you put on any clothing, you're already disguising yourself. For who are you disguising yourself? For other people. That's dishonest. It's not dishonest. As long as you're trying to portray something which is achievable, as long as the gap is not too great. And I said at that time that you judge a human being not by what he is, but by what his ambitions are. Anybody can fall. Anybody can make a mistake. Anybody can be in a state of temporary, hopefully, low-downness. But at least if it's a man who's low down and he's struggling to get up, that's an image of heroism. See a man lying on the floor, he can be drunk. And it's disgusting to see a drunk man rolling in the gutter outside in the street. But there's one kind of drunk man who rolls in the gutter, and there's another kind of drunk man who struggles to get up and struggles to walk straight so that nobody should notice he's drunk. Is that dishonest? That's busha. That means that even in his drunken state, he's ashamed of being drunk. That inspires a feeling of admiration, despite the fact that he's low down. We're not that interested where you're holding. What we're interested in is where you plan to get. What you're trying to be, what you're projecting yourself as. Are you trying to be a Talmid Chacham, or are you satisfied being an Anaharis? That's what's important. Trying to be a Talmid Chacham, the Ribbono Shel Olam will do the rest. If you're prepared to make that statement that that's what you're trying to be, that's where you're trying to go, you can leave the rest to the Ribbono Shel Olam. But if you're satisfied with what you are and you're complacent and you're walking around naked, then you're finished. Then there's nobody who can help you. That's the essence of busha. Busha is the realization that I need some clothes. Busha is the realization I'm not willing to let my friends see me as I really am. I'm embarrassed about what I really am. I'm going to put on a show for my friends. I know it's a show. I know that I'm not really fooling them, and I'm certainly not fooling myself. But I'm too embarrassed to go out as I really am. I'm going to dress up for the occasion. That's busha. And it's that which the 1960s tried to destroy. And it's that which the Midianites destroyed. In the 1960s it was destroyed not only by the hippies, but more important by the psychiatrists. They created a concept called the guilt complex. It was created long before, but it became popular in the 1960s. And the word for busha was changed from shame to guilt. And guilt is negative. Nobody wants to feel guilty. And the way not to feel guilty is to take away the concept of right and wrong. If there's nothing wrong, then you don't feel guilty. And there is such a concept among psychiatrists until the very day that religion is negative because it inspires guilt, and that a system of adherence to right and wrong is negative because it causes guilt. And that's what you've got. Who says there's anything wrong with guilt? If it's busha. That's the essence of humanity. That only a human being wears a suit of clothes. No animal covers himself. An animal is satisfied to present himself as he really is. He doesn't feel a gap between reality and potential. It's only a human being who can be embarrassed to present himself as he really is. And the psychiatrists want to deprive us of this important concept of busha. I had a psychiatrist in my study recently telling me that he is going to go out on a psychiatric crusade against the concept of men and women not touching each other. Absolutely against all modern psychiatric theory. Why? Because it causes guilt. Imagine such a thing. Take away busha. Of course it causes guilt. That's what we want. But there are two kinds of guilt. There are two kinds of busha. There's the busha which we referred to this morning in the Birkas HaChodesh. Chaim she'ein bohem busha uchelimu. We ask for a life in which there is no busha, there is no disgrace, there is no shame. The essence of guilt is to know, number one, that there are two feelings of guilt. Well, let's call it busha, not guilt. There is a feeling of busha which concentrates on the past, and there's a feeling of busha which concentrates on the present. Busha about the past is negative. If one's done something wrong in the past, one has to sit down, figure out what went wrong, why one did it, and try and introduce corrections into one's lifestyle so that it shouldn't happen again. One has charota, one is upset about what happened, one accepts to do one's utmost never to do it again, and one does tshuva, and that's the end of it. There's no place for busha about the past. If you've got busha about the past, you haven't done tshuva. There's no such thing as busha about the past. Busha about the present, that's positive. That I am not what I could be. Not that I was not what I could have been. That I was not what I could have been is over. That's finished. The tshuva is done. That's it. Busha is the present. And as much as there is a Yetzer Hora to wipe out the concept of busha altogether, a Yetzer Hora represented today by hedonistic philosophies and by psychiatrists, not all psychiatrists, but some psychiatrists, certainly the majority, there's an even greater danger that the Yetzer Hara tries to hop onto. That is the danger of making everything past tense busha. Because that way he's got you. If he just avoids you ever feeling present tense busha, then he knows you'll never become a great person. Now there are only two ways of doing that. Either you've got to become depraved, that there's no morality whatever. Alternatively, you've got to feel guilty about the past all the time. And this is something which strikes many people who are getting involved in Yiddishkeit. They become obsessed with concern about things of the past. Not only things that they did before they became involved in Yiddishkeit, but things they did yesterday. That's what the Yetzer Hara wants. Just worry about yesterday. As long as you don't think about today, the Yetzer Hara is happy. As long as you don't think about today, the Satan is in his element. You have no chance of making progress.
Just worry about yesterday. Do you know what you did yesterday, you wretched so-and-so? How could you have done it? And you think to yourself, what a tzaddik I am. My conscience is talking to me. Isn't it wonderful how bad I feel about what I did yesterday? And the next day you feel even worse. And the next day you feel even worse. And then your body language starts becoming all introverted. And then you start walking with a hunch. And then you become oppressed. And then you can't concentrate and you can't learn. And you become completely uncreative. You become frustrated and you do more aveiras. And it gets worse and worse and worse. That's perfect. That's just what the Sultan wants. That's not what Busha is all about. There's tshuva for the past. Busha is for the present. How am I now? Can I afford to expose myself as I really am to my friends? That's what my question has to be. And if I can't afford that, then at least I have Busha. I'm embarrassed about it. And I want to try and fix it up. I would like tomorrow to be what I really appear to be. The difference, of course, is we don't try and make ourselves outside what we are inside. We make ourselves inside like we are outside. Toichoi kabaroi, we say. What is integrity? Making your inside like your outside. Not making your outside like your inside. If we're going to make our outsides like our inside, we should all strip naked and walk around in the nude. That's making your outside like the inside. But that's not what the Torah is about. The Torah says, dress up for the part. Act. But get into the part quickly. See that you grow into the part so that very soon it's no longer an act. And then raise the act a little bit. Take on the bigger part, the higher part, just a little bit above you. And then quickly make teichoi kabaroi, make your inside like your outside. We start off with the way we project ourselves. And we bring ourselves to that level. We do use social pressure. This is what social pressure is. Social pressure is something which appeals to your sense of busha. Something which appeals to your sense of embarrassment. Try and create a social pressure that pressurizes you to act a little bit higher than you are. And then get into the pot. And then move up higher and higher and higher. That's the only way to progress. Otherwise one doesn't make it. We like to think that we don't need to do that. We like to think that we have the intellectual integrity and the spiritual independence to achieve this on our own. But we don't. Never. It doesn't work that way. We have to act a little bit. We have to take on a little bit more on the outside than the inside. Just a little bit. And then fit into the pot. Take on a little bit more and again fit into the pot. This is the work of the Midianites. The Midianites realized how Am Yisrael could fall. All they've got to do is they've got to get Am Yisrael to be attracted to Avodah Zorah. And there's one Avodah Zorah they would be attracted to. An Avodah Zorah which justifies and idolizes hedonism. That would be it. That's the way they would get them. One has to realize that the danger of this today as well. On a national sense, on a national level, Israel's busy making peace with the Arabs. It's all very nice, it's very pretty, it's very sweet. Sadat sends Begin a cable for Shlomo, it's very sweet, it's all cute. But the Arabs aren't the enemies of Israel. The Arabs haven't caused the Israelis any harm. Sure, they fought a couple of wars and unfortunately people have died. But when have Israel's greatest hours been? During and immediately after those wars. In times of peace, Israel has been at their most decadent. So who's the enemy? The Arabs? Yeah, they're enemies. Sure, one has to deal with them. But you deal with them by arming up. Have a good, strong army, as Israel always used to have in the old days. An infallible sort of army, well stocked, so that you can beat them at their own trick, keep ahead of military developments, see that you have the right relationship with the United States, and that sorts out the Arabs. But that's not Israel's problem. The Arabs have never posed a threat to Israel's existence. They've talked about imposing such threats, but it's never been done. Now Israel's existence is threatened. By the 2.5 million Jews living in Israel, and by the many Jews living outside Israel. That's who threatens Israel's existence. By an inflation rate of over 100%, by selfishness, by an inability to give, by a desire to take and take and take, to take from chutzlaretz and to take from each other in Eretz Israel. Always taking. How much more can I take? It's a corrupt and immoral society inside. That's where the problem is. And the Satan is smiling. And the more he sees Begin and Sadat hugging and kissing each other, the more he smiles. I fooled them. They think they're making peace with their enemy. And now they don't even realize that they're facing the biggest challenge of their entire existence. I'm not telling you this because there's anything we can do about it. Don't help if we write to Begin or we write to Sadat and say, you idiot. Don't waste time with the Sadat. What's he going to do to you? You've got an army for Sadat. Get busy on the real issues. Educate your people to be human beings. Educate them to be kind, sensitive to one another. To want to help one another. Give them a bit of idealism. Why are you losing 10,000 people a month? Why are they running away from Israel? Soon you'll be left at peace with the Arabs and no Jews in Israel to deserve that peace. What's the good of that? Look at the real problem. I'm not telling you this because we must write to Begin or write to Sadat. I'm telling it to you because look how clear it is to see such a thing when you're looking at somebody else. It's so obvious. But it's not obvious to them because they're involved in their problems. And we do the same. We never identify the real enemies. We always look at the apparent enemies, and it's not the same thing. The real enemy and the apparent enemy is something else altogether. The real enemy is complacency. The real enemy is the guy who tells you you're doing just fine. Be honest, be yourself, be spontaneous. Just don't try and put on an act. That's the real enemy. That's the guy who's ensuring that you can't make any progress. All the other things are relatively irrelevant. The degree of sexual depravity, once you've taken down the barriers, once there's no bushel, to what levels one can drop. When I was in America a year ago, I said jokingly, but publicly, soon in America, I said, this was a year ago, there'll be a case in front of the Supreme Court of America, of the United States of America. And the case will be that the prohibition of incest is unconstitutional. It restricts the rights of certain individuals. And they laughed. It was a terrible joke. I was there a few weeks ago, and somebody who was present came to see me. Said, it's happened. There is a case before, it's not at the Supreme Court yet, but there's a case presently in California claiming, and it's going to go to the Supreme Court, that incest is against the American Constitution. The prohibition of incest is against the American Constitution. Once there's no bushel, no Torah, there certainly is. The Americans don't accept Torah. So what's the only thing that can keep them on a moral path? Bushel. Bushel's gone. There is no bushel. There's nothing to be ashamed of. Everybody talks about, not only in America, about their family planning and what kind of contraception they're using and all the most intimate details. There's no bushel at all. Talk about anything to anybody. There's no such thing as privacy. There's no such thing as respecting other people's privacy. There's no such thing as demanding one's own privacy. We're open. We're natural. We're real. All the hang-ups are gone. The bushel has gone. And once the bushel has gone, there's just no end to how depraved it's going to become. Homosexuality is legalized. Then you've got to have homosexual representatives in Congress. Yes, that's where we're holding at the moment. Otherwise it's penalizing them as a group of people. And then you have the homosexual lobbyists. And one day you're going to need a homosexual president. And that's not the end of it. Now it's incest. You're going to have a brother and sister one day living together in the White House. Otherwise it's a racial discrimination or discrimination of some other source. There's just no end to it. The last barrier before Mashiach comes was bushel. The conscience inside the human being, just something inside you which said, this is not right. I may be doing it, but I wouldn't like anybody to know that I'm doing it. Once that's gone, the whole society is corrupt. And unfortunately, we're living now in a society where there is no bushel. And we're facing a situation where either the war of the Midianim from that stage has achieved certain success, even though it's been delayed, or else there are still Midianites somewhere around in society still today. Whatever it is. But one has to understand the degree to which this is serious. Now one understands why Moshe is told, wipe those people out. You cannot have a society if there's one Midianite around. Not a Jewish society and not a non-Jewish society. Not a Torah society and not a secular society. People who worship Baal Peor have to be destroyed. A society which recognizes depravity as an ideal has no place whatever in my world, says God. And they have to be utterly wiped out. The men certainly, because they design the philosophy. So even the babies. Anybody who's been exposed to such a depraved philosophy has to be wiped out. The women are a different story. You can be quite sure the women didn't design the philosophy. A woman has a natural sense of busha. A woman has a natural sense of tznius. You can imagine that it's very likely that the women went along with it because of the pressure, but it's not the kind of thing that any woman would willingly and happily practice. I think I've told you before that when I gave a series of lectures on similar such concepts once at the University of Cape Town, to a mixed class, there were 200, 300 people present, men and women together. And I talked about certain things, and particularly about free love and this kind of thing. And eventually I asked how many people agree with what I've said, and three people put up their hands. So I thought, there's something wrong, because everybody sat and listened very carefully, and everybody was sort of nodding as I was talking, and now you ask a straight question and you get a funny answer. So I thought, there's only one thing I can do to save myself. And I asked the women to go out. And I asked the men, how many of you agree with what I've said? And a few more people put up their hands. Called the women in. I said, how many of you agree with what I said? They all put up their hands. They wouldn't do it in front of the men. When you have them on their own, they all accept, all agreed. That isn't the way to live. You don't move in with somebody. Coming out on the plane, I read, you wouldn't believe the article. I mean, these are fascinating, these things on aeroplanes, because it tells you what's going on a bit in the world. I read an article written by a lawyer about what kind of contract you must be sure to make if you move in with a guy. Right? Don't move in without contracts, because then you're going to have troubles when it comes to splitting. So he describes a contract. The contract is a marriage. That's it, it's a marriage. It's everything which is contained in a normal marriage, Jewish marriage, non-Jewish marriage, it makes no difference. But the same provisions that you have in any marriage agreement is what he's talking about. But chas v'sholem, don't call it a marriage. So that's not marriage, it's just an agreement which covers living together. It covers what happens in the event of children and who'll decide how they'll be educated, the whole lot. That's a marriage. People on the sugar, people have just gone mad. Women don't like it. And this was written for the protection of women. The article was telling the women, don't move in with somebody without a contract. In other words, get married. Call it what you like. The men don't like the contract. They don't like the marriages and they don't like the contract. One can imagine that the women didn't like this philosophy of Baal Peor. It doesn't go, it goes against the grain of any woman. Those women who could have been involved in it, it's too late. Might go against their grain, but they've been exposed to it. And anybody who's been exposed to this and who's lived it, it's so hard to get it out of their brains. Even when they're Jewish people, how much more so when they're people whose whole society is based on this and their whole ancestry is based on this depravity. It's just not possible to get them out of it. The only people that the Ribbono Shel Olam is prepared to save are the little baby girls. Because they would not have a natural tendency to such a philosophy, and they were too young to ever have been involved in such a philosophy. So they are saved. But chas v'sholem, not anybody else. So great was this mitzvah of wiping out the Midianites, and one now understands why. One sees what they are and what they did, and what a threat they were to society. So great was this mitzvah that the Midrash actually says, brings a proof from here that the Ribbono Shel Olam always does what his tzaddikim wants him to do. Moshe was craving to see the day that the Midianites would be wiped out. And the moment God tells him to wipe out the Midianites, although he knows this is his last mitzvah, and when this is done he dies. And you know how Moshe wanted to live just a little bit longer all the time. Even if he wouldn't have got into Eretz Yisrael, he still wanted to live longer. He loved living, he loved luck, he didn't want to die. He could have delayed the mitzvah of wiping out the Midianites. No, he does it immediately. So craving is he to see them wiped out. So much does he desire to see them wiped out. And yet he doesn't do it himself. He won't go. Why not? That we'll discuss next week.